You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 17th of November, 2021. As always, I ask for your financial support on Patreon, and it's very possible that in the near future, I may be doing, video lectures, maybe even small classes, as well as, all my work I'm doing now. Obviously, as you know, this is a full-time job for me, and it's extremely important that I eat once in a while. So I always appreciate your support. Today we're talking a bit about Islam. This show deals with, as you may have figured by the title, Russian Orthodox Nationalism, both in terms of ethnic Russian stuff, the political ideology of nationalism properly defined, and its ideological context. Since my PhD is actually in the history of political thought, this is a combination that is pregnant with all kinds of possibilities. Islam has interested me only because it's constantly in the news, but most of all, because of the nature of its spread, the intense form of imperialism, rapidly and almost right away from its foundation, and the fact that the liberal elite see this somehow as a good thing. Because of the Judaic connection, any destruction of Christianity is a good thing. Islam destroyed Greek Orthodox, Slavic Orthodox civilizations, not to mention Latin-speaking areas, North Africa, all the way to Spain, as we all know. But it's very striking that it was right away. One of the things that, I'm not sure if I ever brought this up on the show before, St. John of Damascus, one of the great church fathers, was actually the financial secretary and translator to the caliph in Damascus, Walid al-Malik, who died in 715. And of course he knew both Greek and Arabic, which was a very important qualification. This is a new religion in the new empire that was being built. And he wrote a treatise against Islam, which is one of the first, if not the first, Christian response to this new religion. John inherited his position from his father, soon promoted to even better position of financial specialist. And again, this is a newly formed Islamic state. His grandfather, Mansur Sarjun, was involved in assisting the Muslims in consolidating the control over Syria in the middle of the 7th century. So for this, John's father was raised, given the position, I think he was governor of Damascus under the caliphate. So St. John was raised in their household. So very few people, non-Muslims, knew Islam better than he did. He knew its political idea, he knew its daily behavior, the life of its elites. He knew Islam like no Christian of his day, or certainly today, could ever hope to know. But there's nothing surprising about it. You read about Greeks and Orthodox people working for the Muslims early on. Nothing surprising about this because it was policy at the time to keep the older Greek administration intact. The Mansur name is Syriac rather than Arabic. And eventually, of course, St. John had to resign from his position was forced to because this was a anti-Greek party was developing in the empire. So as soon as there are sufficient Muslim bureaucrats that can master the old Greek and Syrian language in the administration, the old families were removed. And both Islamic and Jewish authors have tried to downplay his role as secretary in the caliphate because, well, they claim he didn't have this position, or he didn't require a thorough knowledge of the Quran, or his position didn't require it. And James Addison, in The Christian Approach to the Muslim, wrote that St. John displays a thorough knowledge of Islam and is fully at home in the Arabic language, often citing the Quran word for word and showing his familiarity with the Hadith. So it was precisely his linguistic abilities, which is part of his upbringing, that made him absolutely indispensable. And often that doesn't get stressed enough in people who are studying the great patristic author. St. John of Damascus is one of the greatest minds in the Orthodox world at the time. So what does he say? He says, talk about the early foundation of the religion. These used to be idolaters and worshipped the morning star and Aphrodite, whom in their own language they call Khabar, which means great. So down to the time of Heraclius, they were great idolaters. From that time to the present, a false prophet named Muhammad appeared in their midst. This man, after having chanced upon the Old and New Testaments, and likewise, it seems, having conversed with an Arian monk, devised his own heresy. Then, having insinuated himself into the good graces of the people by a show of seeming piety, he gave out that a certain book had been sent down to him from heaven. He had set down some ridiculous compositions in his book and gave it to them as an object of veneration. I've always made the claim that Islam and Judaism are very similar, and it can't be a coincidence. And also that Islam is primarily a legal and militarist doctrine rather than a religion, strictly speaking. The St. John here is also saying that it's not really a separate religion at all, but is a heresy using both Old Testament and some of the older Arian teachings, that is to say that Christ is not God. In other words, there's nothing new there, no new revelation, but the act of Muhammad filling a power vacuum between Persia and Byzantium is the key element. So the three ancient sources, St. John himself, the Emperor Constantine, and John the Deacon, all of first-rate ability, argue that Muhammad was not the founder of a new religion called Islam, but that Islam was merely just another Christian heresy coming from the remnants of Arianism and Nestorianism. Muhammad had consistent and ongoing revelations throughout his life. Most of his political and military decisions came from these. Now, centuries later, they were put down in the Quran. And the problem with some of it, you know, St. John goes through a series of problems with it. But one of them is that these revelations weren't seen by anybody. They were often while sleeping, occasionally self-interested, but always without witnesses. Now, here's the problem. That is not the doctrine of the Quran itself. St. John says, and he's almost speaking to this imaginary Muhammad in front of him, he says, although you may not marry a wife without witnesses, or buy or acquire property, although you may not receive an ass or possess a beast of burden on witness, and although you do possess both wives and property and asses and so on through witnesses, yet it is only your faith and your scriptures that you hold unsubstantiated by witnesses. For he who handed this down to you has no warranty from any sort, nor is there anyone known who could testify about him before he came. On the contrary, he received it while he was asleep. And even the nature of these revelations, the Quran's explaining these revelations and where they come from is odd. You know, in the Old and New Testaments, revelation is fairly simple. God speaks to whoever he wants to. He mentions, whatever he needs to say, usually pretty clearly, especially in the Old Testament, the prophets, etc. But that's not the case here. Initially, he wasn't even sure who this was. And the angel, and his might be angels. The violence towards Muhammad in the early period is remarkable. In fact, it causes him great despair. He says this, This is from the Ishak book from 1955. I will go to the mountain and throw myself down, that I may kill myself and gain rest. So I went forth to do this, and I was midway in the mountain. I heard a voice from heaven saying, O Muhammad, thou art an apostle of God, and I am Gabriel. I raised my head towards heaven to see who was speaking, and Gabriel in the form of a man was there, feet astride the horizon, saying, O Muhammad, thou art the apostle of God, and I am Gabriel. He was very confused as this was going on. And there was a time where he believed this was Satan. And even at that time, not even a pejorative concept of Satan. But he hated the fact that he had to choose between them, that he was the one who was chosen to reveal them, which is the case in props of the Old Testament too. But some of the verses are references to the so-called revelations that Satan proclaimed through him. So it wasn't just Allah that spoke. And there was this demonic element which confused him. That there were more than one entity speaking with him. And Satan himself. And this is stated at the time. He seized the opportunity. He wanted to preach a compromise, because Muhammad's own tribe refused to accept anything that he was saying. Satan said that he could compromise with the tribesmen. They want to maintain their own gods, so let's bring it in slow but sure, a syncretistic form of worship. And that itself became a part of the Islamic creed. So the point is that opponents were saying, if Satan could use you as a mouthpiece, and on this occasion right now, why couldn't others? Why couldn't other entities, other spirits be doing this? How would you know one way or the other? So, shortly thereafter, it was Gabriel who did inform him of his error here. And preaching a explicitly demonic doctrine did cause him a bit of a problem later on. With that, though, the accusations that come after that this error, that Christians are idolaters, another problem that St. John brings up, that Christians are idolatry, because, you know, Muslims don't use images. And John says, well, there's the Kaaba stone. This is an object of idolatry, he said. In a very early medieval form of sarcasm, John says, you know, just because Abraham had relations with a woman on it, or tied a camel to it, doesn't make it an object of worship. He suggests that some of this develops because there really is no tradition. It was a wildly syncretistic system. But he does, you know, less humorously, talking about the Kaaba stone, says, this stone they talk about is a head of that Aphrodite, whom they used to worship and whom they call Kabar. Even to this present day, traces of the carving are visible to careful observers. So given all that, it's not surprising that he says that Muhammad just simply made up the law as he went, with revelations so convenient that they border on the comic. He writes, Muhammad had a friend named Zayd. This man had a beautiful wife with whom Muhammad fell in love. Once when they were sitting together, Muhammad said, oh, by the way, God has commanded me to take your wife. The other answered, you're an apostle. Do as God has told you, and take my wife. Rather, to tell the story over from the beginning, God said to him, God has given me the command that you put away your wife. And he put her away. 7 days later, he said, now God has commanded me to take her. Then after he had taken her and committed adultery, he then made this law. Let him who will put away his wife, and if after putting her away, he should return to her, let another marry her. For it is not lawful to take her unless she had been married by another. Furthermore, if a brother puts away his wife, let the brother marry her, should he so will. That's from the Quran itself, as John cites Surah 2225 and following. In other words, these are very convenient. And you don't see any parallel, and certainly not in the Old Testament. They're quite the contrary. The prophets never received this convenient permission for such behavior. But the commands of God, especially in the prophets, were consistent. The revelations from God, you know, strain credulity and show how radically different Muhammad is from anyone else. But the key issue, and what's always concerned me about this era of history, is its spread and its growth. The Old Testament certainly has examples of divinely ordained slaughters. Although, remember, those were commands of God to destroy peoples engaged in human sacrifice. As God flooded the world in Genesis, his commands to destroy a tribe or village were the same order. Muhammad cannot claim any such divine sanction. But still, the bulk of the historical treatment offered in the Old Testament is reversed. The sins of Israel lead to constant wars, defeats, and foreign occupation. It was the Israelites who eventually were slaughtered. I've said a million times in the past, this obsession with Israel's unworthiness and their own chosen status is unique in ancient literature. It's a very ineffective form of propaganda. Even a cursory reading of the historical book shows Israel to be a moral and political disaster in every way, despite the brilliance of the prophets and the divinely inspired writings. Unlike later Christianity, Islam promises a worldly glory as well as a heavenly one. And the spread of the two groups couldn't be any more different. Until the reign of Emperor Theodosius of Byzantium, the church struggled, as an alternative, of course, to the official polytheism and, of course, Judaism. It was fairly peaceful at the time and spread through, really, the determination of its martyrs. But even when it became official under Theodosius, emperors over and over again threw their support behind the heretical sects of the church, as much as the Orthodox variety. Orthodoxy was always a suffering sect, even under the so-called Orthodox state. But Islam, however, used military force from the very beginning, and even during the life of Muhammad. And part of this is why I claim that this is a military doctrine, even more so than a religion. God is distant, is isolated. He has no real contact with humanity other than the Prophet himself. After that, it was the Islamic State, the state as an entity that served as a substitute for divine intervention in history. The cities were brought under Islamic rule by conquest and conquest only. The main churches were turned into mosques. And of course, the key issue is that Jews did very well under the Islamic State, and they were a huge part of this spread. And since they were considered possible allies of the Byzantine state, they suffered tremendously. Hilary Belloc, as many of you know, offered one of the great descriptions of early Islam, and it's really been almost never refuted. Because Islam is so unique in history for the radical and violent, really sudden foundation of its society, he says, such a revolution has never been. No earlier attack has been so sudden, so violent, so permanently successful. Within a score of years, from the first assault in 634, the Christian Levant had gone. Syria, the cradle of the faith, and Egypt with Alexandria, the mighty Christian sea. Within a lifetime, half the wealth, nearly half the territory of the Christian Roman Empire was in the hands of Mohammedan masters and officials. And the mass of the population was becoming affected more and more by this new thing. And of course, they're spreading today through this migration issue. Only in this ahistorical morass of modern America can anyone claim that the Crusaders from Western Europe were in any sense aggressors in the wars that defined much of the High Middle Ages. If anything, these Crusades were poorly organized. The rearguard action did more harm than good, especially in that they destabilized the Byzantine state, which was the only substantial and knowledgeable force against Islam at the time. But there still has to be something about Islam that permitted this rapid-fire development. It can't just be that the cause of Islam's strong and radical introduction to world history was, you know, based solely on the sword. Of course it was, but it's got to be more than that. So Belloc says, it was a combination of the attractive simplicity of the doctrine, the sweeping away of clerical and imperial discipline, the huge immediate practical advantage of freedom for the slave and riddance of anxiety for the debtor, the crowning advantages of free justice under few, and simple new laws easily understood that formed the driving force behind the astonishing Mohammedan social victory. The courts were everywhere accessible to all, without payment and giving verdicts which all could understand. Now, despite Belloc's hostility to Islam, this is a fairly balanced view. Yes, they spread exclusively by fire and sword. No one can deny that under any circumstance. But once imposed, followers were, were able to enjoy what Belloc just described. Now, Islam did, and again, this is something, this is a thesis for me, for many years. Islam was able to thrive, because you had the two dominant empires, the Byzantine, of course, Byzantine Rome, and the Persian had completely exhausted themselves. So after the Battle of Nineveh in 627, both empires left this no man's land in the Middle East. So something like Islam, which used the lucrative caravan trade, and had the simple laws that Belloc mentions, could quickly fill it. It was easy to take advantage of the discontent in the reign of any empire, and the Jewish element in Islam's rise cannot be discounted. In fact, Jewish backing is what made Islam successful where everything else had failed. So these groups, semi-Christian groups out of communion with Constantinople, the Nestorians, the Monophysite, it's easy to mobilize them, and they were quickly mobilized. So once the initial conquests were complete, it's real easy to offer protection to merchants and traders going back and forth between the Greeks and the Far East, and offering them protection, possibly even lower taxes. So using local elites to continue the rule of the old system was an important reason why at first it wasn't really a revolutionary conquest. That explains how St. John of Damascus' family was where they were. Maintaining the local customs was extremely important in the early rise. And among the early tribes, playing one off against another wasn't difficult. Fred Donner writes, who's writing in 1981, a very famous work on Islam, says, "The methods outlined above did contribute much to the state's cohesion, above all by providing organizational goals that were super-tribal in the context of justifying ideology. But the day-to-day stability of the new regime and the effectiveness with which the rulers were able to control the thousands of tribesmen now under their charge and bring them to do their bidding was also the result of the elite's keen awareness of the ingrained strength of tribal ties and the ways in which these ties could be used to foster rather than obstruct their consolidation of power." So, part of his analysis is that the Muslim movement stressed the importance of a state, a strong, more or less centralized administrative unit. And of course, it could engage in the warfare, prolonged warfare, and then rationally rule a conquered territory. So once the internal dissension among the tribal leaders of the area, Arabian nomads was stopped by showing the benefits of concerted action, the rest was just a matter of good government. So it was extremely rational from a strictly financial point of view. Now, both Persian and Byzantium did have rationalized state structure. In other words, bureaucracies that don't require a charismatic leader. And that's why their empires lasted over time. They weren't modern, of course, since noble families of all types maintained the state rather than your typical centralized bureaucracy. I mean, they had them, and they were important, but they weren't nearly what they are today. But it did see the later concept of a state in outline, what the modern state will eventually become. A bureaucracy, one that's professional and nonpartisan, can take over when weak or corrupt monarchs would otherwise destroy the gains that their more competent forebears had earned. So once those two giants receded in the 7th century, imitating their form was not at all difficult, especially where the income from raiding the caravans was incorporated into the plan, and the Judaic connection is absolutely essential. So income, ideology, the vacuum, power vacuum, and really the desire for peace, all serve the Islamic state very well in its early years. As Belloc already said, the simplicity, the stress on commercial equality, and all the rest made it tolerable, a tolerable alternative to the Byzantine system. Its religious divisions made the empire really struggle, especially at its fringe levels. And this isn't, this isn't something that's dealt with at this level often. Now, I've said before, and I've said it about 9 million times, that Islam and Judaism not only are very similar to the point where, one sprung out of the other, but that they have been in a close alliance from its foundation to this very day. The way that history is written now, these texts, in English anyway, history texts are really just as apologetics for Islamic imperialism. It's not because they like Islamic law, but because it did damage to their enemy, Christianity. They also universally support the Jewish view of world events. So, one example of this is the idea that Christians were permitted to remain so long as they paid an extra tax. And that was it. Without fail, that's followed by the exclamation that Islam is far more progressive than the Christians were at the time. The extra tax the Christians were supposed to pay, the jizya, usually glossed over in history texts, as if it doesn't matter, but it was of immense significance. It's assumed that this tax was a financial one. It was not. After Serbia was conquered, and the Orthodox Balkans were conquered, it was non-monetized. So then, what would that jizya be? In kind, of course, but that's not the entire meaning of it. The tax meant a lot. You see this in all of the, I don't think there's an exception to this. Major history books in the era, the tax is the only thing the Christians had to do. That shows you how progressive Islam. That tax, though, the jizya, you can find this in the Quran, what this really means. And it says, fight those among the people of the book who do not believe in Allah, nor in the last day, nor forbid what Allah and his messenger have forbidden, nor embrace religion of truth until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. That means that money is not really the issue here. It's about submission, not money. So the term taxed is used dishonestly, at least equivocally. So in the Balkans and elsewhere, the tax was done in public, where those paying needed to humiliate themselves in some way. The beard was pulled. Sometimes the palms were smacked. The payers were simply beaten. So the concept of jizya means that your life is ransomed in cash or some other form of payment. It's a method of extortion. In other words, the non-Muslim's life is forfeit, and therefore the jizya is extracted as recompense. Again, this is part of the reason why, apart from the sword, Islam was successful. Even Marco Polo, this is quoted from Ibrahim, 2013, says, according to their doctrine, whatever is stolen or plundered from others, a different faith, is properly taken. And the theft is no crime. While those who suffer death or injury by the hands of Christians during an attack are considered as martyrs, and these principles are common to all Saracens. So, your contemporary historian will say that the jizya was a way to avoid military service, which is a falsification. They're trying to make the tax even less onerous. But there's no documentation for this. The modern left has pretty much invented it. It's not to say that, you know, Christian and certainly Jewish societies didn't penalize non-believers, but in the Orthodox world, it's never been a matter of statute. The mentality that Polo cites above exists nowhere in the Middle Ages, and certainly has not been squared with the faith of the New Testament. To avoid this fate, and, you know, this is really the concern of mine in my Serbia book that I wrote many, many years ago. What happened, of course, is we're going to be called genocide. So the middle of the 14th century, we're spreading ahead here, because this concerns Europe. The Turkish Empire, which became one of the central Islamic empires, taking advantage of the disunity of Serbian princes, took much of southern Serbia, Greece, and Bulgaria. And after that, but once the Serbian resistance had fallen, about 100,000 Serb refugees fled to Hungary. This stream of exiles will be seen many times well into the 18th century. Serbian refugees were settled in the southern parts of the Austrian Empire as a special military force protecting Hungary in exchange for ethnic and religious autonomy. The group became very important and for the most part was granted religious tolerance. This became the Krajina, the military border, and gave Serbs a reputation as first-class fighters. Using Serbian refugees as their main fighting force, the Austrian empire became an important sponsor of Serbian resurgence. The point of this, though, is that you had a mass drive into exile. Serbia was, the early 15th century, completely depopulated. Turks wiped out all remnants of resistance, leaving a few villages or monasteries behind. And this is why you had this mass exile movement. Turkish forces were garrisoned in the cities, forbidden to Serbs. Land was a matter of service to the Sultan, was granted only to his most loyal people. In other words, you had a oligarchy. The Balkans, as an entity, was divided up by about 1,000 Islamic landholders. And Serbs became serfs of the Turkish elite, and they were known as raya, which is another word for cattle. Of course, Lisagoyim springs to mind. All resistance was destroyed, and that's where, in our European context, where the tax was imposed. The countryside was left alone so long as the tax was paid on time. And to a great extent, it was, when it became monetized, it was a cash payment, but not early on. It was certainly in Islam's interest to see the community preserved, because the emir, or the extended family unit in the Serbian case, was maintained for this reason. So rural Serbia became a federation of independent villages, and the cities were completely alien, because only Jews and Turks could live there. This became central to Serbian nationalists, because it was strictly a peasant ideology. And certainly Montenegro held out because of its topography. But it was certainly strangled. I have a three-part series on Montenegro, which I did about a year and a half ago. So, again, the point of all this is to explain that this is one of the results of what ultimately comes down to the tax system. The tax was this destruction of all resistance. This is, I can't stress this kind of importance. The life was always forfeit, and especially if you resisted. Now, conversion to Islam, going back now to the early days, of course, was never directly forced, although it did happen. But the benefits of conversion were substantial. The Islamic doctrine in governing non-Islamic populations is to be found in the Conditions of Omar, which is named from Omar al-Khattab, reigning until 644. Its authorship is controversial, but it was very important in Islamic political thought. Conditions of the churches cannot be constructed or repaired. Churches must be able to house Islamic soldiers or dignitaries wherever they is necessary. You cannot display a cross on them. And in terms of dress, Christians may not dress like Muslims, and so as to pass for them. And of course, Jews were never given these restrictions. So these conditions of Omar, and this is a document in ideology, says that Christians may not possess or bear any arms whatsoever, nor gird themselves with swords. Beyond that, court testimony was not equal to a Muslim. Christians and Muslims were not officially treated as equal in that sense. Christians were assumed to be lying. And anyone who fights with a Muslim at any level received the death sentence, even if it's in self-defense. Conversion, of course, is how you avoid this and other manifestations of the jizya tax. Many other incentives were offered. Like the penal laws in Ireland, such harsh domination could not be enforced all the time, and it was unwise to enforce it often. This was, however, the official view, and you cannot discard it. So, as I mentioned before, the much later depopulation, slaughter of the Balkans is an outgrowth of this very same mentality. On the other hand, of course, Jews were treated as Muslims. Noam Avdor, he writes this in 2015. Ottoman rule is much kinder than the Byzantine rule had been for the Jews. In fact, from the early 15th century on, the Ottomans actively encouraged Jewish immigration. Western European Jews received three invitations to settle in the Ottoman Empire. Two were from Muslim sultans, Muhammad II in the middle of the 15th century, and Baal II in 1492. The third came in a letter sent by Rabbi Yitzhak Sarfati in 1454 to a Jewish community in Europe, in the first part of the century, that, quote, invited his co-religionists to leave the torments they were enduring in Christendom and to seek the safety and prosperity in Turkey, unquote. Rabbi Sarfati wrote that here every man dwells at peace under his own vine and fig tree. That's quoted in another book, The Gold Readers, in 2015 book. In other words, this was a new Israel. The Islamic regime in the early Middle Ages, and much later too, became a haven. The rabbi I mentioned here, he sets out a whole range of privileges the Jews received under Islamic control. And there were some elite Greeks who had some of these, but only in the most elite families. This was Judaism as such. As I said, with St. John, Turks needed Greeks for their administrative knowledge, and even in medicine, I should say, too. So Jewish, Venetian, and Greek elites did very well under the new Islamic ruling class, but just the elite factor. The Orthodox peasantry alone suffered. Those who were already elites in the old world either had to convert to the new or die. So to preserve what you have, conversion was essential. But Jews in the Ottoman state, later on, in the Ottoman Empire, they were the most loyal and prosperous pillar of the regime. Jews received important positions at court. The physician to Murad II was a Jew, Ishak Pasha. Solomon the Ashkenazi was a central financial player under Selim II. He was so powerful that the Venetian embassy reports back to Italy that he has possessed the mind of the Sultan. He wrote the peace treaty with the Venetian Republic and was almost completely autonomous. He was the regime for a while. Solomon, in fact, in the work of Aydin Media, he's the key figure in the reversal of Venetian expulsion policy in the 1570s, where they had thrown the Jews out. The customs offices of the Sultan were a Jewish province entirely, and Jewish shipping was identical with the quote-unquote Turkish Empire's overseas investments. That was the main competitor to Venice. So, financially speaking, Jews were the Ottoman Empire. The Jewish elite was the wealthiest stratum of Turkish society, and like in Babylon, the two groups theologically merged. In the 16th century, Joseph Nasi was a key financial mediator under Selim II, Murad III, near the end of the, a century after the fall of Constantinople. One of his roles was to strengthen the Jewish political and economic network that was to dominate Europe soon thereafter. The strategic hubs were London, Antwerp, the Italian republics, and Krakow. As I mentioned not too long ago, the Judaizer heresy in Novgorod was their attempt to bring that city under its sway. It was defeated, thank God, to Prince Ivan III of Moscow and St. Gennadius of Novgorod. The banking sector was exclusively Jewish. All international trade went through the Jews. Near the end of the Ottomans' existence, that population numbered among 400,000, about 3%. But their control over international trade was total and absolute. Now, the tiny Greek elite that functioned in the Phanar, to a great extent, and I said that they benefited from this, as time goes on, I'm thinking this is more of a myth, in the sense that they were secondary by far to the Jewish and Italian merchants, the bankers of the day. The Orthodox Church was targeted for extinction. You had direct methods of persecution, you had indirect methods. Serbian churches, apart from everything else, I said after the conquests of the Balkans, they were sold to the highest bidder. Greek merchants, who did well under the multinational Turkish Empire, bought the Serbian bishoprics and monastic houses. I said this in my Philotism articles here. So when you buy a monastic house, when you buy a bishop's office, a see, that requires loans. And the new owners then had to tax what was left of the Serbian economy. Under the Turks, the Serbian church did not have clergy. so a strong family orthodoxy developed. Monks, living as extremely poor hermits and wanderers, became the only source of religious and national education. All of this is an extension of that notion of taxation and its, you know, semi-theological foundation. But, you know, in the peasant mind at the time, elite Greeks, Jews, Italians, Muslims, they're all lumped together as a single group of oppressors, all of whom took advantage of this huge Ottoman market and the position of Serbs and other Slavs. Upon the expulsion of the Turks, you know, we're talking, you know, centuries after the original, early Middle Ages, Serbs and Bulgars created church structures that were Slavic and non-Greek, and that became the elite Greeks and the Fanar condemned it, that's called it Philotism, the Robert Synod of 1872. Not to mention the fact, we all know what the blood tax is. People talk about the blood tax as if this is different. The blood tax was the jizya. There, hundreds of healthy Serbian boys were taken back to Turkey each year, made Muslim, and eventually trained as part of the elite part of the Sultan's army. This is the Janissary. This isn't different from what the jizya is. This is, it's paid in blood. It's paid in bodies. And of course, it was this Janissary Corps that became almost independent became independent of Turkish civilian control and it terrorized Serbia in the late 18th century. In fact, this is the terror that caused the first uprising of the Turks in 1804. Now, I know that we've, you know, jumped in historical terms. The point I'm trying to make is that that nature of that tax became a justification for their occupation policies wherever they went. When leftists and Muslim apologists talk about how magnanimous they were, well, you could be magnanimous after you've slaughtered all resistance. When you've depopulated an area, it's very easy to be generous to what's left. And that's the key issue here. But no matter what era we're talking about, and I've made this point 100 times, the recurring theme is that the modern secular West and Islam has supported fundamentalist regimes as a battering ram against their opponents. Now, I say this because this has been the policy. Of course, the Jews, they always did very well with them. And even after the foundation of Israel, but that, of course, created a huge division that did not exist before. And because of the Jewish connection, you have this constant support of Islamic governments. You had this in amongst the Venetians, where the minute the Byzantine Empire fell, that was it. They moved in and took over that trade. They often allied themselves with the Turks. The British, ruled the Ottoman Empire. And they had to maintain it as a way to block Russian influence. They trained the mountaineers of the Caucasus against Russia as a way to block their expansion southward. They became the Chechens, the allies of the London banks at the time. And, of course, the Albanian movement, bankrolling of ISIS, the support of Chechen rebels, and all this Bosnian fundamentalists, that shows that policy continues. Nothing's ever as it seems. Whether we're talking about the early Middle Ages or yesterday, the same power centers seem to show up. Now, I want to stress the Ottoman Empire. I mean, we started off talking about the early Middle Ages and John of Damascus and how this developed. But Islam has remained consistent in its methods of achieving success. And it's always concerned me, the massive spread of Islam so fast. I can't think of anything else that can match it. So this was Hilary Bullock's idea that, on the one hand, the method of this kind of extortion and, you know, carrot and stick policies, which were done brilliantly, and I say that the Jewish holy was a big part of it. But the jizya tax is essential, not just as an actual tax, you know, but it really was never an actual tax. This was almost an ideology that justified and explained how the empire functioned. Jumping ahead again, jumping ahead to the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire became a semi-colony of the Great Western Power. As Islam in the Ottoman Empire began to wane, it was clear that Turkey was one of the most backward societies of Europe. Its finances came under Western control. Unlike Russia or Serbia, the peasantry in Turkey bore the full brunt of the tax burden. Now you had the tax moving, now this is actually money, from their colonial subjects now to Muslims themselves. The peasants in Turkey bore the full brunt of this, paying tax farmers something like 30 or 40% of their crop. Large-scale agriculture was controlled by Western capital anyway. So it soon reached the point that Istanbul had a few coastal cities received grain and flour from abroad, since Britain exported almost the entire plantation crop. This is typical of free trade. Foreign capital has a monopoly on the production, or had a monopoly on the production and export of Turkish tobacco, controlling entire areas. So foreign capital acted as the organizer of production and focused on the semi-feudal dependence of peasants and extremely cheap labor. So now we've gone to reasons for the massive and rapid spread of Islam to now what happens when it declines in the Ottoman Empire. The point is, the system that I described, coming from its medieval foundation and the jizya tax, and therefore the creation of oligarchy, this tiny group of people who held the power, and many of them were not Muslim, isn't stable. Oligarchy isn't stable. It requires constant revolutionary agitation. Therefore, by the time we're talking about the end of the 19th century, the system was cracking. It had been cracking for a very long time. The Russians had almost smashed it out of existence. There was an attempt to industrialize under the Sultan Mehmed II, and Mehmed V just died in 1918. You had a lot of natural wealth in the empire, but because of the nature of oligarchy, it didn't work. Because of the nature of the system, because of the nature of this oligarchy, based on this early medieval tax system, it became up against competition, the British and French, and modernity, which it never was able to match. You had already dependent peasantry exploited, so foreign businessmen could reap huge profits that never benefited the Turkish treasury. Almost no steel was ever produced, making Turkey a raw materials exporting semi-colony of the West. So again, we've gone from the creation of this oligarchy, extremely unstable system, really in the hands of foreigners, of Jews and a handful of Greeks, maybe a handful of Armenians. Now, as the Western powers developed into a shadow of its former self, with the nature of the system, the nature of that expansive oligarchic interest is too unstable. So by 1881, the administration of the Ottoman public debt, which is actually an office, was created by the Western powers. It took all productive capital out of the empire in exchange for debt reduction. In other words, the foreign oligarchy never modernized the economy. So this administration included representatives. It's like a bankruptcy. You had a credit committee, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Austria-Hungary, and even local creditors. And this is how foreigners began to completely control the finances of the Ottoman state. You reach a point where extracting from colonies simply isn't profitable anymore. There's not much left to extract. When you have this foreign oligarchy, and the Jewish oligarchy, of course, controlling finances, they're living from extraction, not from production. They had no interest in production. So this early medieval alliance of Jews and Muslims, continuing for a very long period of time, ended up leading to the absolute destruction of the Turkish state. And I'm saying, of course, that it's the jizya tax mentality that is the cause of this. And going back to St. John of Damascus, that is the irrational and almost bizarre nature of the theology itself that put the state in charge, rather than any kind of, there is no church there, of course, there is no clergy. The state is all that matters. In the very beginning, I said, this is what Islam is. So that means if the state falls, Islam falls. And now, by the time you get to the early 20th century, the main expositor of Islamic doctrine, at least as far as Europeans are concerned, is the Ottoman state. Now, in bankruptcy. This is the nature of that oligarchy. So they called it Western court camarilla, based on really the corruption of bureaucrats and the unlimited arbitrariness of officials. Everywhere you had embezzlement, you had arbitrariness, you had corruption. Again, this is what happens when there's nothing left to extract. Even the Sultan talked about divide and conquer to mobilize Islam against Christians and sponsored the pan-Islamic ideology that was to keep the state together. Largely a colony of Britain and France, this movement shifted to Germany, which soon took control of the empire's armed forces, and this is why Turkey was on the Central Powers side in World War I. The Turkish government tried to use Germany to strengthen its army and its suffering economy, as well as to break the monopoly of the Entente over her resources. And I'm saying that this 20th century development comes directly from the irrationality of the Quran itself, as St. John talked about, and the development of the tax idea. So this so-called Ottoman state, and one example, of course, is Albania. The so-called Ottoman state gave the so-called Albanian national movement some kind of independence. Albania was a post facto name given to Islamic landlords, as I mentioned, seeking to protect themselves from the rage of Christian peasants. Talked about when they took over, about 1,000 oligarchs were eventually given the land there. There was a bit more than that by this time. But one example here is that Albania was when these guys were frightened of the revolutionary movement, the Orthodox nationalist movement, and joined in the in what they call Albania. That's really what this is. It's not an ethnic identity. It was never meant to be. There was no Ottoman Empire, of course, any longer. It was entirely under the control of foreigners. So even by World War I, Vienna named and created this Albanian nation, which coincidentally, of course, cut Serbia off from Montenegro. So you had scattered tribes, the mountainous regions, declared some sort of Albanian confederation in 1912. Again, Islamic landholders, they feared reprisals. Again, this is what happens with an irrational system, an irrational mentality, the nature of the tax, the nature of the colonial empire. This is why I began talking about this massive spread and how rapid it was. What it created, again, from a strictly legal and political point of view, because this is, the religion isn't that important. The state is all that matters. Where the state is, Islam goes. This is what it created. The nature of this gave, and they needed Jewish assistance to establish themselves. This Jewish connection eventually destroyed them. So the Islamic landholders had to join together and pretending to be anti-Turkish all of a sudden because they were terrified of what the nationalists may do to them, simply made to protect themselves and created Albania. I'm not talking about any, there's whether an ethnic Albanian or not, is not the point I'm trying to make. But for the isolated and alienated urban elite, the Montenegrin mountaineers were a source of both admiration and fear. So, the point is, of course, this, decay of the oligarchy into this federation now is faced with Orthodox nationalists all over the place. And it's an extremely positive movement. I know we're kind of confusing here, and I'm going over a huge swath of history. But it's all held together by the fact that Jewish Alliance in the beginning, the Jewish Alliance became an oligarchy, and the oligarchy destroyed it. And it's difficult to do over 1,000 years in one hour, but the point stands. I use the Albanian example because this is what happens when that oligarchic mentality then falls apart to the point where they're in serious trouble. There was nothing left to extract. The landlords were faced with this massive rebellion, finally, from the Christian people who had been repressed for a long time. And they created something called, you know, what the Albanian Confederation, which is at least its foundation. And again, it's pretty rare to find anyone who doesn't admit this purely opportunistic creationist Albanian nation. The Zickel book from 1994 says one of Serbia's primary war aims was to gain an Adriatic port, preferably Durrës. Austria-Hungary and Italy opposed giving Serbia an outlet to the Adriatic, which they feared would become a Russian port. They instead supported the creation of an autonomous Albania. They had no idea what an Albanian was, so the crafters of the Treaty of San Stefano, the peace that led to the creation of independent states and the ruins of this Turkish and Islamic state, they took the land, divided among the victors, especially Bulgaria and Serbia. And that's where this disaffected group of landlords created the prison league. And then, of course, it became Albania later on. 47 Ottoman beys, where the landed oligarchs, got together and created this entity. Now, I use the Albanians as an example to show the absolute decay of an empire based on this Jewish oligarchy. The oligarchy was the single dependent factor from its foundation to its destruction here in the early 20th century. It's in the central concept of the tax, the jizya tax, which led to their undoing. And just the example of Albania, it shows you how when this falls apart, when this is destroyed, when the oligarchy has simply exhausted itself, this is what you have left. You have this level of opportunism. Even Otto von Bismarck called Albania a geographic idea and certainly not a nation. It wasn't taken seriously as an ethnic group. It was something that existed to give some legal foundation to the loss of territory to the Orthodox Slav. But oligarchy was always built in to the Islamic idea. I mentioned St. John in the beginning, and it's really important to note that he's, tearing apart the ideology, the confusion that Islam was based on. That not knowing if it was Satan or Gabriel doing the talking, the opportunistic mentality, the fact that Islam is this ideological doctrine, military doctrine, that was created given the split between the Byzantine and Persian empires, creating this no man's land. This is not really a natural creation. And what happens, especially when there is this Jewish factor, purely exploitative, of course, leads to destruction. All of those variables taken together lead to the disaster that the Ottoman state became. But it is a mistake to make the claim that they were ever, obviously at war with Judaism, that they were ever at war with the Western powers. The only powers that ever consistently fought them, the Orthodox Slavs in the Balkans, and of course Russia itself, and the Cossacks in particular. But when the oligarchy exhausted itself, you have these things like Albania. You have this disastrous, these pockets of Muslims in Europe that created Kosovo and this nonsense. That created the violence still in parts of really parts of Montenegro, as well as Macedonia. Because they derive from this mentality, they derive from this oligarchy, this is what they have become. And if it wasn't for Western power, if it wasn't for the creation of Israel, in 1948, Islam was a dying religion. Because where the state goes, Islam goes. So this has been a lengthy excursus into the Islamic idea held together by the idea of the tax and the Jewish dominant element, which few people are willing to deal with. Islam is an outgrowth of Talmudic Judaism, not an independent religion, and in fact, it's a military doctrine. Thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.